The Holy Gospel according to St. John, the first chapter. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light, so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. This is the testimony given by John. When the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" He confessed and did not deny it, but confessed, "I am not the Messiah." And they asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" He answered, "No." Then they said to him, "Who are you? Let us have an answer for those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?" He said, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as the prophet Isaiah said." Now they had been sent from the Pharisees. They asked him, "Why then are you baptizing if you are neither the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet?" John answered them, "I baptize with water. Among you stands one whom you do not know, the one who is coming after me. I am not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal." This took place in Bethany, across the Jordan, where John was baptizing. The Gospel of the Lord. Perhaps Anthony Miranda from Chicago had never heard the line from the prophet Isaiah, "I hate those who rob." Maybe it's because he had never had anyone share with him that it was wrong to rob. Maybe it was that he heard it, but he just never listened to it. Maybe he came from a situation where he didn't know any better. But Anthony, a few weeks ago, decided to take a gun and to rob a man on the streets of Chicago. So at gunpoint, he informs this man that he wants him to turn over his money. Now, here is the problem that Anthony ran into. The man that he was holding at gunpoint was a champion from the Ultimate Fight Club. And quickly, there was a power transfer that took place on that street in Chicago, where the man holding the gun was now no longer the person in power. Would it be that the words that we use carried that same kind of power to turn things upside down? What was it that one young woman in New Oxford said this week? "I don't have the words to talk about what has happened to my friends who were killed in the car accident." Are there words that have enough power to cause things to turn around? I want to take a look at this reading, the second lesson from 1 Thessalonians, a letter written by Paul to the Christians in Thessalonica, believed to be probably the earliest of Christian writings that we have, the earliest written certainly in our collection of Scripture. It was a community that Paul had established after his mission in other cities. One of the things that we learn about this city of Thessalonica was that it was common among many Roman provinces to allow room for other religions and the worship of other gods. New Testament professor Mark Powell says that there was room for other temples, other rituals, and other worships in Thessalonica. There was room to worship the gods and goddesses Isis and Osiris, Serapis and Kibiris. Those should be the names of your next four children, if you don't want them to be confused with other children. But what we find out is that while there was room in Thessalonica for these other gods and these other forms of worship, there was not room for the Christians. And what is it about the Christians that made them offensive that the other religions did not have? Kevin Rowe, in a book, World Upside Down, referred to me by Professor Carey, unpacks what that difference might be. He pointed out that there was room in the Roman Empire for various worship of other gods and other religious practices. It was part of a greater understanding of how their nation, their empire, was to be led. And it was part of a larger system, and every god and every religious practice that was permitted was in support of this larger system that helped them make sense of divinity and the divine relationship with earth, how the earth came together and was to be understood, how humans related to each other. The Christian message found itself proclaiming a different lordship, that its lordship was rooted in Jesus of Nazareth as being the Lord of all creation. And it was that lordship that was offensive to the way that the Roman Empire understood and structured itself. To acknowledge Jesus as Lord is to make an acknowledgement that there is something different about that faith claim than any other claim we make for ourselves. That faith claim changes the frame of reference for all of us. If you want to see how the situation in Thessalonica develops, you can visit the book of Acts, which is a wonderful accounting of Paul's missionary work in Thessalonica, how he went into the synagogues to teach, how he also gathered among Christians, but he also in the marketplace used his own skills of making a tent, and with Silvanus and Timothy made tents because he didn't want to be a financial burden to that Christian congregation. Pastor Sadie and I don't know how to make tents, and so we will remain a burden to this congregation. Paul was much more open with his generosity, I guess, than we are. Sooner or later, however, the Jews started to raise concerns about what was happening in their community, raising those concerns in a voice loud enough to get the attention of the city leaders. Paul and his cohorts had to escape the city in the darkness of night and run to another place. Jason, one of the leaders of the community, had much of his property taken from him because he was considered supporting those Christian leaders. Paul writes to these people to make sure that they are remaining faithful after his departure, and commends them for their faithfulness when he hears of how they're sticking to it. But he also speaks to a legitimate concern that the people have. They had believed that the second coming of Jesus was on its way. And as Paul at the time, that every single one of them would be alive when Jesus returned. But some of the members of the Christian community were starting to die before the return of Jesus. And the concern was, will these people encounter the lordship of Christ if they have died before his return? And it is Paul in his letter who teaches them that indeed, even though they have died, they will encounter the presence of the crucified and risen Christ. And it is that claim that reframes their Christian living. Let's take a look at how we frame our own thoughts and our own lives. Daniel Kahneman, in a book, Thinking Fast and Slow, gives us this example. He talks about someone named Diane, who at the end of the day walks to the bank. Now let's talk about the conclusions that you would draw from that statement. It might be that Diane was in a business where she handled money, and it was her job at the end of the day to make the deposit. It might be that it was payday, and she wanted to get to the bank right away in order to put her paycheck in. There's some of the staff that we only see when the paychecks are available here at the church as well. It's amazing how as soon as that check is signed, whoosh, they're right there. So maybe she has her paycheck, and she wants to put it in the bank. But the conclusions we draw are usually related to money. But what if I told you that Diane was a certified canoe instructor? Which bank is she heading to now? She's not heading to the bank where we have our money. She's heading to the bank of the river at the end of a day's work. The conclusions that we draw can be reframed so that we understand what's happening in a new light. And to make the claim that Jesus is Lord is to reframe the conclusions that we draw about human life. How do we go about changing our thinking? To go about undoing this lazy way that we have of drawing conclusions and sticking to those conclusions. It is through regular discipline, regular practices, that by engaging in those regular practices, change the way we think. There's a wonderful list at the end of this letter to the Thessalonians that puts in front of them their religious practices that will change the way they live. And you have three of them in front of you today: to rejoice always, to pray unceasingly, and to give thanks in all things. To rejoice always. That doesn't mean the sense of giddy, jumping up around because something good happens and you just want to enjoy that temporary moment because we know the shoe is going to fall at some point down the line. To rejoice is the capacity to name what is good and to celebrate what is good. My son is at the point in his 8-year-old life where the way he defines whether a person is good or not is by how fast they run. Of course, that's because he can run fast, and he is good. So anyone else who can run fast is also good. And he likes to do this comparison thing. Am I faster than this person? Am I faster than this person? He wants to keep taking me on races, and I still, even in my middle-aged life, can still beat him. I'm just glad he can't go the distance, because he probably could outrun me if there was a longer distance involved. Well, as we had spent some time visiting my brother and his wife about 2 weeks ago, on the way back, he made the claim that people are good who can run fast. And I said, oh, let's think about this. This was one of my better parenting moments. About 80% of the time, I usually snap at him or yell at him or discipline him, and I actually had the wherewithal to actually talk about it instead. I said, who did we just visit? Well, Uncle Jim. I said, do you think Uncle Jim can run fast? No. I said, why not? Because he has muscular dystrophy. And there was this silence. And he goes, but Uncle Jim is good because he loves me. And at that moment, he redefined for himself what good meant. Rejoicing, that ongoing practice of identifying what is good, identifies for us what no longer bears our time and our attention. To pray unceasingly. Now, there are a lot of benefits to prayer. There's a wonderful discipline of prayer. But what I want to talk about with prayer is the fact that prayer is an interruption. I try to keep a regular prayer discipline, and I'm probably about 60% effective with that, where I start my day with prayer. I try to gather my thoughts for prayer at noon and to end my day with prayer. What I find is that when that alarm goes off at 5:45 in the morning in my own head, that what I want to do is roll over and go back to sleep, but my call to prayer interrupts my sleep. What I find at noontime, if someone comes in and says, you want to go to lunch, it's really hard to say, no, I need to have my time of prayer first. And at nighttime, when I want to simply go to sleep, it interrupts that time. Prayer is an interruption. But it's important to be interrupted because it tells us that the things that we are interrupting may not be as important as we thought they were in the first place if they can be interrupted with something else. Prayer interrupts. To give thanks in all things. The best way to fight temptation in your life is to learn how to start giving thanks for what you have. There's an ongoing burden every year in most of our houses to get decorated for Christmas. And inevitably, after I have the lights on the tree and I plug them in again, that strand right in the middle goes out. And what I do is I just buy a new strand and plug it in and place it in the middle instead of taking the old one off and starting again. And then at the end of the year, I forget that that one strand is dead. I pack it up and I put it on the tree for the next year. But in the midst of that sense of having to get done, and sorting through all of those little metal hooks, as I pick up each ornament, I'm reminded of the person that gave it to me. To Loretta, to Alice, of some of you. And it reminds me to be thankful for those who are present in my life. To give thanks is the best way to fight the temptation to think there's something better out there than what we have now. What we hear is in the city of Thessalonica is that Paul and his cohorts spent time working in the market. And as they talked among themselves about their faith, others would listen in. And likewise, as people came to do business with them, they would engage in conversation about matters of faith. And others would listen to those conversations and become involved. That the witness happened in the secular community. Wherever people are going about their business. You are asked to take the words that you have and to speak of God and matters of faith in all the places that you find yourself. And brothers and sisters, to use those words to announce that Jesus is Lord of all. And to announce that Jesus is Lord of all reframes the way we look at what is happening around us. There are words, brothers and sisters, that can be spoken to the families and those who have been impacted by the young people who were killed in car accidents this week. There are powerful words that can be used. Words that I have been called upon 13 times in my ministry to share with parents as we bury their children. You see, we as parents give our children life. The problem is, as soon as we give them life, we've already given them death. Our prayer is that we will not be alive when they die. But there are moments when that's turned upside down, and parents witness the death of their children. There are powerful words that can be spoken in the depth of that despair. Those words that Jesus is Lord are words that are stronger than any clenched fist of any strong man that is walking the streets of our country. Amen.